it's great to have everyone out here. I think when we first started talking about a workshop like this, you know, we were kind of worried if there were enough people who'd be interested in these sorts of things. And Rob and Steve have put in a lot of effort, and I think, can you hear me? I'd like to say thanks to them for putting it together. I think it's interesting to have a workshop like this. I don't think there's been anything like this in the past. Today, but let me just make one comment on the coherent state arguments before. People sort of say, why am I not commenting? Partly it's just boredom. Part of it is that I really think that if you think carefully about what Rob talked about in his talk, that the issue is one of people who think of reference range as classical versus people who think of reference range as quantum mechanical, people who think that you can have classical fields in quantum mechanics and people who think you can't. And, you know, they're sort of talking orthogonal languages almost. I think we all agree on sort of what's going on operationally in these issues, but the sort of interpretations leave something to be desired. So today, I'm not going to talk about anything controversial, thank goodness. I'm going to talk about how certain dynamical processes, how measurements cause the localization in relative parameters and some relative degree of freedom of two systems. And the initial motivation from this came from the sort of stuff Barry was talking about, and I'm going to talk about it in a little more detail, which were questions about, you know, why do you see interference in a BEC? So here's a sort of famous kind of diagram of two BECs interfering. They sort of initially spatially separated, and then they let the clouds move together, and then you see an interference pattern. And if you sort of use a mean field theory approach, then the way you describe this interference pattern is to say that the two BECs are in coherent states. But those coherent states violate the superselection rule for atom number. And so other people will jump up and down and say, no, you're not in the coherent state, and we get similar arguments to the sorts of things that we hear in the optical case. I sort of lean to the side of things being really quantum mechanical and that ultimately there won't be classical objects, and that forms part of motivation for the sort of stuff I'm looking at today. The other sort of issue, I think that it's actually a physical issue as opposed to sort of a semantical issue, is symmetry breaking something dynamical? And this is something I'll have a little bit to say about, but it's still an open issue in my mind. In which systems is it valid to put in symmetry breaking fields as if they were really there? But more recently, my motivations are to do with construction of reference frames. So if you want to actually build a reference frame, you're going to have to grab some objects and establish some kind of relationship between them. And these very simple models I'm looking at today are sort of very, very toy theories for doing that kind of stuff. The other things that motivate looking at localization of relative parameters, for people who are, you know, really mathy and you want to believe that everything was just some relationship between different objects, and so, you know, we're trying to understand the Machian features of quantum mechanics better. And the sort of last motivation comes from a paper which appeared in Science last year by Rao, Dudley, and Burnett. And this paper basically does the sort of stuff that has been done in BECs and for light fields and so on. It does it for relative position localization. And they're trying to argue that particles interacting, say, with light and so on, can end up with well-defined relative positions in a way that it's clear that they'd like to see something that goes beyond regular decoherence theory. And so that's something I'm somewhat sympathetic with. I think if you're going to have decoherence theories, then they should be really relational decoherence theories and decoherence in relational parameters of the system. And so we're trying to go a little bit further than what these guys do. Most of this work, I should say, has been done by Hugo. Hugo Cable is a grad student at Imperial College, and he loves doing lots and lots of math, and he's very hardworking and so on. And he'll be graduating in a year, so if anyone wants to give him the postal, I'm sure he'd be amenable to them. So let me spend some time on this sort of very simple case that Barry talked about. Because there's some interesting features that I don't think we realized when we wrote that paper that Barry mentioned. So the issue is, given sort of two cavities that initially are in Fock states of light, so they're in number states of light, possibly different numbers of photons, that leak out of N mirrors with some transmittivity epsilon. Once you start detecting photons, you start creating entanglement between the two cavities. So in the case that only one photon is detected, then at, let's say, the left detector, then my initial product state of N photons and M photons is going to evolve to some entangled state because you don't know which cavity the photon came out of. Now, if N is roughly equal to M, then the second photon that you detect is about three times more likely to come out in the same port at the same detector that the first one came. And this process can build up and build up, and essentially what happens is that you get a large entangled state where you have a very ill-defined relative total photon number, which gives you a well-defined phase, and you can see an interference pattern at the two detectors. Now, because it's going to be useful for the spatial scattering pattern, I'm going to go into a little more detail how you treat these things quantitatively. So because I'm not really interested in this thing as a dynamical process, I'd like to really think of the two systems, the two optical cavities, as being some systems I'm trying to establish a relationship between. In this case, a well-defined optical relative phase. And so I'm going to ignore the sort of the outside modes and the beam splitters and detectors and just treat that whole evolution as some environment, as some sort of set of ancillas and some measurement process. And then I can just write down the action of that measurement process as some completely positive map with very simple Krauss operators, depending on which port you detect at. And the Krauss operators are just going to be either the sum of the two annihilation operators for the cavity modes or the difference of the two annihilation operators for the cavity modes. And if you sort of mess around with how that acts on the initial two number states, then, as Barry pointed out in the last lecture, your initial two number states can be expanded in terms of coherence states, where you just have some phase factor that enforces the total photon number to be fixed. And acting these Krauss operators on the coherence states, as in here, well, you know how a coherence state behaves under an annihilation operator, and you basically just pull out the complex number which describes the coherence state into the front of the superposition. So you get that after you've detected A photons at the left detector and B photons at the right detector, you get the state psi AB has evolved to now some superposition over coherence states, but with now a weight function that depends on theta and phi, which are the sort of initial global phases of the coherence states. And if you work that out, it's very simple to show that in the case where you start with the cavities with the same number of photons in them, this weight function is just something like the product of a sine function with a cosine function. And it depends only on the relative optical phase of the two coherence states. So why does that localize things? Because if you look at how this weight function behaves, as you start detecting more photons, the weight function becomes narrower in the relative optical phase. So this is the relative optical phase on this axis. This is basically that weight function, CAB. And these curves are curves for increasing total photon numbers. So in this case, it's for like 3 photons detected, 10 photons detected, and so on. And this is the 20 photons detected. Now, an important issue here, and we didn't realize for a long time that there really was an important issue, is that there are two curves here. So if I go back to sort of my expansion terms of coherence states, and I ask what happens as these as I detect a large number of photons, I don't get just one well-defined optical relative phase between the two cavities, but I get two possible well-defined optical relative phases, either a delta norm or a minus delta norm. So the state sort of in the limit of a large number of detections becomes something which I call the relational Schrodinger cap. Because if you sort of look at this expression here, this second cavity in the way I've written it is sort of a superposition relative to the first of a coherent state with one phase or a coherent state with the negative phase. And this is somewhat problematic for understanding relative localization. And I'll talk a little bit more about what happens to these Schrodinger cats. Unfortunately, we only have numerical results and that kind of thing. We haven't really understood the analytic yet. But before I do that, let me just point out that the value that you localize depends on the ratio of the number of photons that you detect, which detect it. And so we can ask, you know, what is the probability of you detecting A photons at one detector and B photons at the other? And we have some expression that this is sort of an asymptotically correct expression, but it works even for low photon numbers. That's kind of messy. And this is for the case where the cavities have the same initial number of photons. And you can plot this function. And you see something like this. So this should be A photons here and B photons there. Here's the probability, PAB, of detecting A photons in one port and B in the other. And so you see that there are certain values of delta naught which are picked out. So it's not just so, you know, in this process. So these are the sorts of things, I think, that led the group of Keith Burnett to think that they can look at processes whereby this can replace sort of regular decoherence models. This plot is for a sort of given strength of coupling to the environment. So remember, the photons leaking out the end-mirror and impinging on the detectors, and you can think of that as just a strength of coupling to the environment. And so this is for a fairly weak coupling strength to the environment. This is for a coupling strength that is three times larger. And you see that the stronger the focus. The stronger the coupling strength to the environment, the more the localization picks out certain values of delta norm of the relative phase. Now, that discussion is highly unrealistic because in reality, in optics, we never create large photon number states. We don't create Fock states of photons in cavities. If we did, we'd get lots more money from the NSA because you can use them for quantum computing and so on. In reality, what we do create are sort of mixtures of photon number states. So a more realistic scenario is to say, okay, I don't know exactly how many photons are in the cavity, but I know the mean number of photons in the cavity. And the maximum entropy distribution for only knowing the mean is the Poissonian distribution. So you could imagine that your best quantum description of of the initial states of the cavities would just be a tensor product of two Poissonian distributions over number states, which, as we've seen about a bazillion times at this conference, can be expanded in terms of just integrals over coherent states. So in this case, after an evolution of the form before, where you detect some photons coming out, you get a new mixture with the same sort of wave function as I had in the pure state case. And what's interesting is that for this initially mixed state, as far as any relative measurements go for things that depend on the relative phase between the cavities, this state is just as well localized as the pure state case was. And that's something that I find really interesting because it sort of says that the mixtures, even though the ignorance is in photon number, which is in some sense is classical ignorance in a quantity that's conjugate to the phase, and you might think that would mess things up. This process of this dynamical localization, relative localization, is just as good for the mixed states. If you were doing some measurement here, if I look in the limit that I've detected the large number of photons, I get, once again, a relative sort of sort of an incoherent Schrodinger cat, but one in which I have two possible relative phases, delta north, picked out. And that's not great, because it doesn't seem that this is what you would really observe. And so we can do some investigation and say, you know, what's really going on? Do I really have these two different phases picked out? And what you find is that any asymmetry seems to kill the cat. So if there's even a tiny amount of asymmetry in your system, and it doesn't really matter what asymmetry it is, a small amount of time-dependent asymmetry will pick out one of these relative phases between the two cavities. So in the simplest case of an asymmetry would be have very slightly different photon number frequencies, or have another possible asymmetry is to have path lengths that sort of fluctuate a small amount and so on. And then you find that the cat very rapidly gets killed. And that's something we only understand in properly numerical event.
So every field has some line rate. Say you had
I think it is, yeah. And then, so I should say that a lot of work was done on numerical simulations. What Hugo and I are doing, and it's somewhat painful, is to try and do everything or as much as we can analytically. People have run a lot of Monte Carlo simulations on these things, and you find that just very small amounts of detuning, Klaus Molnar, for example, has run a lot of optical, sort of quantum jump type simulations, and he finds that, you know, a small amount of detuning between the cavities will kill the cat. In fact, he didn't sort of understand it like that. He just sort of realized that he couldn't get proper interference unless he introduced some kind of detuning and so on. But we're trying to get a handle on this analytically, but unfortunately, despite me yelling at Hugo for the last 3 days, we haven't gotten to that point yet. So this is all very much work in progress. But I think there's something interesting there, because I think real physical systems, you do have such asymmetries, and so there should be some generic argument as to why any asymmetry will do this. So this is the case that, you know, that sort of quite interesting, because it corresponds to this question of, do the independent lasers interfere? I like the fact that the mixed state localizes just as well as the pure state case and so on. Another natural question to ask would be, what about other initial mixed states? What if I have thermal light in each cavity? So if I had thermal light in each cavity, of course this equation I've written is completely wrong, then I just sort of have some kind of Gaussian mixture of coherent states initially in the one cavity and Gaussian mixture in the other cavity. And you can go through a very similar analysis. Well, Hugo can go through a very similar analysis. The easiest way to just sort of see the difference is to think in terms of, we need some parameterization, some way of sort of looking at how good a relative localization has been. In the optical case, we do this by asking what would be the visibility of an interference experiment that was performed sort of after I've had this dynamical localization. What's a sort of visibility of some interference experiment, subsequent interference experiment. And you can do a calculation of this that goes on for pages. And I'll, of course, just show you the plot. Here's a plot of the expected visibility. This is for a Poissonian initial mixture. And this is for a thermal initial mixture. And this is really the strength of the coupling to the environment on the x-axis. So the stronger that you couple to the environment, the more your visibility sort of peaks to. And in this case, it saturates at a half. And the reason it saturates at a half and not one is because we still have, this is an analytic calculation, we still have the Schrodinger cat there. If you collapse out the Schrodinger cat, the curves go up and will go to one. But we don't know we don't understand the physics of that properly yet. But we expect curves that are very similar to this. So you see that the thermal line, it doesn't localize as well as the Poissonian. I mean, it's a bit slower, but it certainly does become just as well localized. And for optics people, that's not going to be so strange, because first order coherence doesn't really matter whether you like thermal or comes from the laser and so on. Anyway, so this is sort of sets the background. This is our very simple example that we use as our paradigm for understanding some sort of dynamical localization. And what we really wanted to do was to analyze the science paper that I showed you before, because when you read it in depth, I mean, there's a lot of deficiencies in their argument. And this, certainly if you want to think of this as actually being a process that, you know, occurs in nature, is it possible that the reason, you know, atoms are well localized with respect to each other is that in the early universe they scattered light in such a way that their relative positions all became localized and so on? These are the sorts of questions we want to answer. And so we need to understand this measurement-induced relative position localization. So there's two examples that they considered and that I'll talk about in a little more detail. The first is the first is what we call the rubber cavity. So in this case, and they're doing this because people are trying to do an experiment, I believe, something like this. It's a case where you have two massive mirrors, but not so massive that they, you know, their positions are sort of well localized with respect to the lab. So the mirrors are somewhat free to move around. And they look at the case that you inject single photons through Max Ender interferometer that's built so as to use these two mirrors. And then you detect the photons coming out the output of the Max Ender interferometer. And in the process that's quite similar to the one I described, you see that the mirrors localize in their relative position. I mean, the thing that sort of made that clear to us is that this curve in their paper, which is for the localization of these two mirrors, is exactly the same as a curve that Barry and Steve and I had in another paper. Of course, we didn't get a science paper out of this, but partly, I think, because we understood the problem a little bit better than they did. There's something interesting, though, in this paper, unfortunately, they did only quantum trajectory simulations. So these curves are numerical, but of course we have analytic expressions for them. There's a lot of issues once you start looking at the free space scattering of particles and issues to do with the quantization volume and so on. The main issue that Hugo and I have decided to look at is the case that instead of taking these two mirrors to initially be in momentum eigenstates, to take them being in thermal states, so we decided that you know, if this sort of stuff is really going to be done in the lab, these things are not going to be in perfect momentum eigenstates. They're going to be in some sort of Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So we've looked at the situation, and I'll talk first about the rubber cavity example. So we've looked at relative localization of position when you have initially thermal particles, either thermal mirrors or just thermal single particles. The nice thing is that the thermal distribution, so here's a thermal distribution in momentum with a sort of Maxwell velocity distribution at some temperature T. This state is equivalent in a similar way to we do the tricks with the optical coherent states. It's equivalent to a uniform mixture over Gaussian states with a mixture over the mean position of the Gaussian, the width d that's determined by the temperature and the mass of the particles. And we normally just take the initial mean momentum of the particles to be zero. So we have to do an analysis very similar to the last one. In the case of the rubber cavity, the two sort of mirrors that are flexible, the Krauss operators are very similar to the ones in the optical case. They're just going to be a sum or a difference of translation operators. But for free particles, the situation is quite a lot messy. And so depending on what angle you scatter your light, you get really quite messy Krauss operators that depend on the angle and depend on these displacement operators. And you also have a different Krauss operator for the case where the particles don't scatter. And this sort of causes a lot of mess and calculations. But we can go through a somewhat similar analysis to the optical case. Certainly in the rubber cavity situation, you can get things that you know, very analogous to the optical case. They're not exactly the same. Let me show you a few plots to give you some intuition as to what's going on. So what we plot is the relative position and a probability density. And this is just the initial case that the two mirrors have just sort of initially have no well-defined relative position. And here's how their relative position localizes after just one scattering. So you see that there's really quite a lot of positional localization. But this is for the case that the wavelength of the light is larger than the initial width in the thermal distribution. And you find that the localization in that limit is really quite rapid. After five scatterings, it goes to something like this. And we see once again this periodicity in the relative position localization. That's something that we think will also disappear once we have asymmetry in the system, in analogy with the optical case. But we don't know that for sure. We haven't examined it numerically. What you find, though, is that in the case where the wavelength is sort of smaller than this initial distribution, you're going to get very weak localization. So we have some handle on the sort of physical conditions under which this relative localization could actually sort of say something fundamental about why different positions seem so well localized in the universe. I'm somewhat skeptical as to whether this really has much to do with it, but it's been thrown up by more famous people than me, so it's probably worth looking at. The free particle case is a hell of a lot messier to calculate. In fact, I unfortunately introduced Hugo to scientific workplace, and he started producing calculations, and I call it spec insanity, when a calculation printed in landscape mode goes off the edge of the page. Because Rob does this to me all the time. These people who have scientific workplace, they just make larger and larger and larger equations, and the rest of us go slightly crazy. So it's called spec insanity when that happens. And Hugo certainly does it quite often. But I'm grateful to him for doing the actual calculations, I guess, and he gets out some things that then take me hours to try and put in some sort of simplified form. So in the case of free particles, let me just give you some very sort of simple description of what happens. You have It's very important how many times the particles actually scatter the incoming light and how many times the light just passes through. And you find that after a certain number S of scattering and scattering events and N non-scattering events, you find a position space probability density, P of X, Y, which of course depends, we're only interested in the relative position, X minus Y. And it's an integral over the total mean position of the Gaussians. There's some sort of Gaussian factor. This just means a Gaussian with a mean of x bar over 2 and a width d over 2. And then you have operators which turn out to be basically Bessel functions. So you have Bessel functions to some power. So these Bessel functions take the place of this sort of sine to the a and cos to the b that we saw in the optical case. The expressions are a lot messier to sort of deal with, I guess. But the localization that you see is somewhat equivalent. It's not great, and we've become somewhat skeptical of the results in the IBB paper because we can't really reproduce what they see. They unfortunately don't give any diagrams. They give diagrams that you think refer to the free particle case, but don't. And so they just give a hand-waving description of what happens. And so we don't really know exactly how to reproduce what they say happens. But here's how relative position seems to localize. And this case, we find that the relative position only seems to localize well when the wavelength is comparable to the sort of, I shouldn't really say quantization volume, but the sort of boxes that you're putting the particles in initially. And so this is a case where the wavelength of the scattered light and the sort of initial thermal width of the distributions are roughly comparable, and where a single photon has been scattered. And the probability of the sort of relative position obviously depends quite a lot on whether the whether there was a scattering event, which seems to drive the particles to a sort of zero relative position, or whether the particles haven't scattered. The initial distribution is sort of flat over this thing. So there's localization in both cases. As the number of scattering events go up, you find that the positions at which the localization occurs changes depending on whether you have, here's a case where you have a large number of non-scattering events, and here's a case where you have a large number of scattering events. So, but as I say, this sort of only seems to work in certain parameter ranges. The case where the wavelength is small compared to the quantization volume doesn't seem to be quite so nice. You seem to see some interference patterns building up in the relative position. And it seems to us that, you know, either there's something wrong with the sorts of descriptions they've given in their papers, or maybe they did the numerics wrong, we don't know. Maybe Hugo did the analytics wrong, we don't know. But, you know, there's still a lot of doubt in our mind as to really how well relative position does localize under these kind of events. So, this is a case where you just have one single scattering event. And in the previous case, you know, after a single event, when the wavelength was sort of large compared with the box size, I'm kind of worried that maybe there's some numerical artifacts to do with the size of the box that the simulations are being done in. Then you find good localization, but when it isn't, you don't. So these are still open questions. As I say, we don't really know. We're trying to get an analytic handle on it all. But,
we're sorry. We've got
10 minutes. It's
not more than that.
Okay, well, I'm not going to need it because I'm fairly close to being done. What I sort of came up with just as part of this workshop. So one of the things that, because I like to think that I'm becoming a Machian person, I like to think in terms of, you know, what are the possible relational structures in the universe? And so I came up with a very simple game that I'd like to show you, a game for this workshop, which is, you imagine you have a certain number of patterns, and the game is that there are only two types of relations allowed in this universe. You can either have a well-defined relative position with respect to this person, or a well-defined relative momentum with respect to them. And what we want is to make sure that relations obey sort of transitivity rules, so that if, for example, these two guys have a well-defined relative position, which I'll draw just a bold line, then they can't have a well-defined relative momentum, which I'm going to draw with a wave line. Of course, these guys could have a well-defined relative momentum. So this, in fact, is what an experimentalist often does in the lab. The experimentalist here has a well-defined relative position with some objects in his lab, but sometimes he creates momentum wave packets. And so he gets a relational structure like this. And the important point is that the relational structure can't be completed between these two objects. If I had a well-defined relative position here, then because of transitivity of relative position, this guy would also have a well-defined relative position. So this would not be an allowed sort of relational diagram for the universe. And so, sort of along with Frank, we invented a game wherein you try and complete relational structures in the universe. So you start with a certain number of people, and you ask, you know, each person has to complete a relation. There's a momentum relation, and here's a position relation. And the winner is the last person to draw a relation down. And it becomes a little tricky after a while. Now I'm sort of at a point where I can't put a momentum here, because I would then, between these two points, have a well-defined relative position and a relative momentum. And so I'm sort of at a at a fixed point, and the winner would be the last person to draw it. And I'd like to announce that I am the world champion of this game. Frank, the upstart challenger, tried to take me on and ended up drawing an illegal move. Of course, Frank then gets annoyed, and in typical Frank style, decides he's going to beat me by exhaustive computational analysis of every possible starting point in the game. Frank thinks that maybe the second person always has an advantage, in which case it's not a game. We don't know. We've analyzed the three and four vertices. So this is the sort of reference frames workshop relational quantum mechanical game, and you can all play it on the plane as you go home. Somewhat forward. I'll leave you with just a few of the open questions and problems that we're looking at. What I'd really like to do is understand this relational decoherence in sort of realistic physical situations where you have thermal line, thermal particles, and so on. The other thing that I'd like to do is to understand, we have done some work on asymmetric things. When I take a reference frame, but the point here is that if you want to use some object as a reference frame, you're going to have to fix some quantum mechanical system's relational degree of freedom with respect to that frame, and we want to know what's the optimal way of doing that. How does measurement do that for us? Another issue is this one to do with transitivity. You know, obviously we expect relations to be transitive in the universe, but the dynamics, once you have finite size reference frames and things getting bounced around and so on, are a little bit messy. There's been numerical work done on that. Our analytic approach in terms of coherence state seems to make that look trivial, the transitivity, but we're still working on that. And we'd like to sort of generalize this to generic degrees of freedom, general groups, and general formulations. We're interested in sort of trade-offs in quantum relations. You know, if I have this type of relationship, how does it disturb other types of relationships? We're interested in can the models of relational decoherence be made at least as ugly and unappealing as the regular models of decoherence? And the thing we're most interested in, of course, is how best can we kill our relations? Which is somewhat useful for me. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
There's plenty of time for questions.
So you said at the beginning that you thought this might have something to do with symmetry breaking, but then you didn't mention it anymore. And I'm just wondering what kind of symmetry breaking you talk about. So you're talking about relative parameters becoming localized. So do you think you have a relative symmetry?
I'm thinking of relative symmetry breaking. I think that I just don't believe in sort of global symmetry breaking at all. But these sort of processes, as I say, they're still, you know, you sort of think of them as establishing the operational equivalent of symmetry broken systems, but they still have these periodicities, like periodicities in their relative position. So we can't actually get